Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. Wafa Hakeem Orman, an associate professor in the Department of Economics, Accounting, and Finance at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. She is a labor economist who uses both empirical and experimental methods in her research, which includes such things as the study of open source software and other voluntarily provided public goods, as well as the effects of religion and religiosity on adult outcomes like education, income, denominational choice, and economic growth. As for the latter topic, she has worked with some of our past guests on the podcast, Charles North and Carl Gwynn. Dr. Hakeem Orman's research has been published in journals such as the Journal of Money, Credit, and Banking, the Journal of Economic Analysis and Policy, and the Journal of Behavioral and Experimental Economics, to name just a few. We'll link to Wafa's research papers and some of those other podcasts over at our website, www.researchonreligion.org, so please stop by and visit us. Wafa, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we have had a number of economists as guests on our show before, which I think the general public would find rather odd, given that we never think of doing economics and studying religion in the same category there. Religious studies, that's normally reserved for sociologists, anthropologists, historians, and theologians. So I'm going to start by asking you the same question I asked all of our other economist guests, and that's, how did you ever end up studying religion?
Well, obviously, it's something I've been interested in for a long time. Initially, I started out studying open source software. And the mystery, as far as economists are concerned, is that open source software shouldn't work. It's a public good. People should just free write. People shouldn't just contribute to it and then give it away for free, something that they worked so hard on. But like a lot of other public goods, it actually does work, right? So there are some mechanisms in it. So I was already studying collective action problems. And then while I was a graduate student at the University of Arizona, Professor Ellie Berman from UC San Diego came and gave a seminar presentation on his paper about terrorism. And for the first time, I saw somebody present work that used the club model of religion, or rather looked at how basically religion can be modeled as a local public good. And that was really eye-opening for me, that, you know, you could look at religion in this way. And in many ways, I continued to do my work on open source software, but really that was an intellectual turning point for me. Because I could take everything I knew about collective action problems and then apply that to understanding religion and answering all these questions that seem so mysterious to a lot of people, but make complete sense once you analyze them using a rational choice, club good, collective action framework.
Yeah, I have to share the same kind of experience. I had it with Larry Iannacone, reading one of his papers way back in the, I guess, early 90s, late 80s or so. And it was just this eye-opening experience that economists, they do collective action problems, but that's usually focused around something like a union or trade relations. But all of a sudden you talk about religion where, you know, they have collective action problems and they're even more difficult to solve than some of these other entities like labor unions. And you're like, oh, I bet we could learn something from that. And it's really eye-opening. Yeah. And we've had Ellie on the program before too. We'll link back to one of his podcasts as well. I have to ask too, when you were doing open source software at Arizona and you're advisors were probably going, great, this is a new territory to be exploring. And then all of a sudden you come to them and say, well, I'm interested in economics, religion too. Did they look at you and go, rut-row?
No, I didn't actually tell them about that.
Oh,
I just
good.
Finished up my thesis on open source software. What I did, in fact, is then when I was on the job market, I actually, you know, I was looking for jobs, every graduate student sort of virtually pounding the pavement. And I saw this posting for a postdoc at Baylor University, and it was going to be jointly offered at Baylor and Pepperdine with the two people you mentioned earlier, Dr. Charles North and Carl Gwynne. And it was an opportunity to study the economics of religion because they had conducted the survey. They had received a grant from the Templeton Foundation and conducted the Baylor Religion Survey wave of it, and they needed a postdoc to help them analyze it. And I saw that and I thought, I have wanted to do this for so long. Here's my opportunity, because this is exactly it. There was nobody at Arizona who could guide me in that because they just weren't doing it. You know, they'd managed with the open source software thing, but religion was just too far afield. And then, yeah, here was this opportunity. And so I applied for the job. I interviewed for it, and that was that. And I spent a year at Baylor working on the survey data, but then also working on the paper that ended up in the Journal of Money, Credit, and Banking, where we looked at corruption and the rule of law and religion.
And we did talk with that and Carl Gwynne several years ago, and we'll go ahead and, as I mentioned, post that up again too, so you can hear all about this stuff. But it is pretty neat to see how these opportunities pop up before you, and you just need to take them when you can, which is a great lesson for all our graduate students out there listening. So
yes, it is.
Well, today we want to explore a topic that you've written about in two different papers, and that is the relationship between economic crises and religiosity. Whereas a lot of people look at religion and how it affects economics, now we're kind of turning it to economic crises, looking at religiosity. Uh-huh. You wrote a paper several years ago entitled "After the Farm Crisis, Religiosity in the Rural United States." And more recently, you broadened that topic to include the 2007-2008 financial crisis in a paper called Religiosity and Financial Crises in the United States. So those two are kind of bundled together there. But before diving into the religiosity aspect of this, for those of our listeners, and we tend to get people interested in religion here, not necessarily farm crises, give us a sense of what these two different economic crises entailed and how economists, your standard mainstream economists, would explain these things. Let's go ahead and start out with the farm crisis of the 1980s.
All right. So personally, I wasn't even in this country in the 1980s. I was a child in India during the 1980s. And so when I moved to this country in 2002, I learned over the course of years that there had been this farm crisis, but I really didn't know what it was, much about it. And especially living in Arizona, it wasn't much of a big deal. And then I moved eventually for my job to Alabama, and it was in a casual conversation with somebody. I remember talking to them about it and asking them why they didn't work on a family farm or something, and they sort of scoffed at me and said, there's no such thing as a family farm anymore, it's all corporate farms. No, what are you talking about? And they said, well, it's just been that way since the 80s. And so I actually started reading up on the farm crisis at that point in time just because I was curious. I had never studied agriculture before. I'm not an agricultural economist, and I had a lot to learn. And I read, you know, stacks and stacks of books about the farm crisis from that point on. And so what I learned about it, the economics of it, is that through the 1970s, the U.S. dollar was fairly weak because inflation was pretty high in the United States as a result of the oil crisis and economic crisis and all of that. The inflation was high, the dollar was weak, and commodity prices were booming. So American farmers were able to export a lot of their produce at really good prices, and the demand for American farm products was growing dramatically. You see this big run-up in commodity prices in the late 70s. So a lot of them did the completely rational thing and responded to that increased demand by going out and investing very heavily in farm equipment, increased production capacity, more land. You know, they moved into different aspects of farming. And, of course, to do all this, they had to borrow money, and they borrowed it using their farmland as collateral, which is what farmers have done for, you know, hundreds of years, actually, whenever they've needed to borrow to invest in their farms. Well, things were going great until the early 1980s when, in order to combat high inflation, the U.S. Federal Reserve raised interest rates. And this caused the dollar to appreciate, which in turn reduced global demand for American farm products. And so the price of commodities started to fall, and particularly the demand for American farm products fell as the dollar appreciated. And now all these farmers that had leveraged themselves in order to buy all this fancy equipment and all this increased capacity found themselves unable to pay it back. And of course, what was their collateral? The farm. But then it spread even more in many ways. I mean, I'm sure most of our listeners probably remember the 2008 housing crisis. This was kind of the rural preview of that. It unfolded the way real estate crises typically do, where it started out with farmers unable to pay back their loans and the farm credit institutions now needing to repossess equipment and farmland and that sort of thing. But then, of course, this left the farm credit institutions themselves with too many bad loans on the books. So a number of farm credit institutions went out of business, a lot of these banks that specialized in farm lending. And then this spread the crisis across the country because you now had a tightening of available credit even to existing farmers because they couldn't borrow because these farm credit banks were going out of business. And so you see this ripple outwards. You see it starts in Iowa and Illinois and Kansas, these Midwestern corn and wheat growing states. And over the course of the 1980s, the crisis, the effects of the crisis rippled outwards across the entire country over a period of time and manifested itself as a big crash in the prices of farmland. So that got me thinking, well, we've seen some large changes, I would say, in American religious behavior, right, over the last few decades. And it made me wonder that, did this have anything to do with it? And I was already familiar with Daniel Chen's research about Indonesia and how religiosity and religious practice and behavior itself changed after the economic crisis in Indonesia of the late 1990s, and how people that became more religious and started to attend these Quran study classes in Indonesia after the financial crisis actually found themselves better off as a result, because they were able to tap into these social networks and find this support, emotional support, financial support, spiritual support from these networks that they wouldn't have had otherwise. And it got me thinking, well, surely that must have happened in the United States too. So I looked into it, and that was the start of that particular process.
Yeah, let's continue on with that. You cite Chen's study early on in your work, and that it's really neat that you're able to draw a connection between Indonesia and what happened in the United States in the 1980s. A lot of people would think it's comparing apples and oranges, but speaking of agriculture, we do that all the time, and you can learn a lot from one place and then taking those causal mechanisms and looking at them somewhere else. So, as you mentioned, Daniel Chen, he finds support for people going into these Quran study groups for what again? What were they getting?
Well, in his view, his explanation of it is it was multidimensional. So you start out, I guess you get in trouble for saying people cling to religion, and that's clearly not what I'm trying to say at all. But really what happens is people are in trouble and they need support. And you need many kinds of support, because we're not talking about the average recession here. In each case, whether it's the 1998 financial crisis in Southeast Asia or the farm crisis in the rural United States in the 80s, we're talking about a truly severe crisis that started with asset price shocks and has led to people losing, you know, land and homes, and it's much more severe than an ordinary recession. And so they turn to places that are, I guess economists would say, focal. You know, if you need to find people that are going through the same thing as you, who might be able to help you, if you're looking for a way to understand what's going on around you, make sense of it, you know, how do I process what's going on in my life, and just, yeah, connect with other people in that situation, connect with resources to give you help and assistance, then, well, religion is an obvious place, because it's really important to a lot of people in Indonesia, in the United States, you know, around the world. And it becomes sort of obvious place to turn to as you go look for that support, that comfort, both spiritual, emotional, economic, over there. Now, in the particular case of Indonesia, Chen even found that people who were attending these classes developed this network that then allowed them to borrow money more easily later on when they needed it. They were able to tap into sources of credit, and you know, that allowed them to become financially better off than people who didn't attend these classes. And the data I'm using for the United States, unfortunately, doesn't have that information. I'm using the GSS, which is a repeated cross-section.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm not able to see if people are actually receiving this benefit as a result of their increased religiosity. But I definitely did find that there is a noticeable uptick in religious attendance for in places that are affected by the crisis. And not only that, and there appears to even be a move away from the more, what we call more mainline denominations, and towards evangelical denominations in areas that were affected by the crisis.
That is a very interesting finding. And so let's go ahead and walk through your study, right? So you're reading Chen's study, said, this could be transported over here. And you mentioned the data that you're using, the GSS, which is the General Social Survey, which is a repeated survey that's done by a bunch of sociologists every year, right? Is that annual?
It's now every other year.
Every year
until 2000, the 2002 wave, yeah.
Okay.
Well, no, until 2000. And then the next is 2002. So from 2000 onwards, 98, sorry. From 98 onwards, it's been every other year.
So there's this data sitting out there, and you got some really great ideas spurred on by some other folks, some of your outside reading and some of your own creativity here. Tell us how you conducted the study from the outset and moving forward.
All right. Well, it's a repeated cross-section. But it's the particular methodology I use is something we call difference in differences. So essentially, we had a phenomenon that affected some parts of the country and didn't affect others. Right? So if you were in a rural area during the crisis, and particularly if you were in a rural area that had falling farmland prices, you were affected by this crisis in a way that somebody in an urban area was not. I mean, so a farmer in a rural community in Iowa is affected by this, whereas somebody living in a suburb of Chicago, say, is not. Okay. So we've got a phenomenon that's exogenous to religious behavior, right? Because what's going on with commodity prices and farmland prices clearly isn't, well, okay, I'm making the assumption that it has nothing to do with religiosity, and I think most people would argue it's a reasonable assumption.
Yeah, it seems pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah. So it is, it's not exactly a natural experiment, but it's a quasi-experiment because we've got an exogenous shock to people's behavior over here. So what the difference in difference methodology does is it says essentially we're comparing the change in religiosity between affected areas and non-affected areas. So that's the first step, to look at the change in religiosity in counties that suffered this particular crisis with counties that did not. But then in particular, this crisis should really only affect farmers, or at least affect farmers more severely than other people. Right? So of course, if you were in a community that was primarily an agricultural community at the time, everyone was touched by it. But the farmer that was actually in danger of losing their farm or had lost their farm was more affected by it than anyone else. So we look at the change in religious behavior among farmers who are affected, who are in a county with falling land prices. Compare them against with farmers in areas that are not affected as much by falling land prices, and then compare them with people in other places that aren't affected by it. And so that's the difference in difference methodology.
Okay. So let me ask you about the farmers there. And I would also view, you know, I live in a rural community, and I know that farmers are affected, but also the feed store owner happens to be affected, and other folks like that. In terms of finding the farmers, General Social Survey is taking a wide swath of people throughout the United States, and the farm community is less than 2% of the population. So are we talking really small sample sizes here? How big of a sample are you getting of these farmers and maybe farmer-related people?
Luckily, it was not that small. So it was only about 2% of the sample. But thankfully, the sample, since I'm looking at the GSS starting from 1974 all the way through 2010, that's 2% of almost 44,000 people.
So that gets nice and big.
Yeah, that's cool. The decent-sized sample. Okay. Plus what I used is they have industry, so I just took everybody that worked in agriculture, regardless of whether they owned a farm or a farm worker. If you worked in agriculture, I figured you were directly impacted by this.
Yeah, I think that's a safe assumption here too. And now you mentioned that some places of the country were affected pretty severely. Iowa, Illinois might be cases of that. And other places, you mentioned Arizona, probably not so much. So did you then like match other data sources saying, okay, here in Maricopa County, not so big of an impact. There weren't that many foreclosures as compared to someplace in southern Illinois. How did you do that?
All right. So I got the data on farmland prices from the USDA. That was just, you can download some of it from the website. That didn't go back through the 70s. So I just emailed them and asked if they had the older data, and they sent me a spreadsheet with data going back to the 1840s. So there's a thank you to the nice people at the USDA who were very helpful with that.
Yeah, wow, all the way back to the 1840s.
I know, right?
Wow, yeah.
Like, it's just waiting for me to do something else with it.
You only wish that the General Social Survey could have went back that far. That would have been
exactly.
Yeah, been great.
No, then we'd really get a wide swath. Because apparently this happened in the 1920s as well, by the way. So the 1980s wasn't even the first farm crisis.
Yeah. Yeah, there was one in the 1890s too. So yeah, these recur, and so it's kind of neat that we get to test what has been going on historically here in the 1980s. Okay, so we got farm prices, we got a nice big survey that includes some farmers, farm-related folks. The next question comes up, measuring religiosity. And religiosity is kind of a big thing. It's, you know, do you believe in God? Do you attend church? Do you donate? What different facets of religiosity did you look at, and how did you measure all that stuff?
All right, so the good thing is the GSS asks a whole lot of questions about religiosity. So the primary one I used was attendance at religious services. And they ask, how frequently do you go? It goes from never to a couple of times a year, a couple of times a month, you know, weekly, more than once a week. Right. So I just use that as one dependent variable. Then they also ask about the strength of religious attachment and the frequency of prayer. And I use those as sort of robustness checks. And the reason they are robustness checks rather than primary model is they only started asking about frequency of prayer in 1982. So I don't actually have that data from the 1970s for that.
Okay. So let me ask just a quick question for those of you who don't know what a robustness check is. What do you mean by that?
Oh, it's just we want to ask the same question in many different ways.
Okay.
And try and answer it in many different ways. And that way, if our results hold up each time, well, robustness can mean different things depending on the context. But the way I meant it this time was to try and answer a question in many different ways. And then if we get the same answer each time, we have a finding that we can believe in more so than, say, if I had just found, oh, this increases perhaps religious attendance, but it doesn't do anything at all to prayer. Well, then what's really happening here? You know, was it just a fluke? Was there a measurement problem? But instead, something that holds up for prayer and strength of attachment and frequency of religious attendance, now that's a stronger finding.
Okay. And you found that there was pretty much a great deal of robustness in your measures.
Yes. And the effects on the coefficients are slightly weaker when we use prayer and strength of religious attachment, but the results still hold up.
Okay. The other thing that I noticed, you said that you're going back to the 1970s. And a lot of people, again, say, well, you're studying the crisis in the 1980s. Why do you need to go back in the 1970s? Explain that one.
Well, because if we want to look at the effect of a decline in farm prices, it's also important to know the flip side, right? So if we want to know a difference in difference, we have to know what was going on before in order to study the before and after.
So that makes perfect sense as well. So you're going 1970s. And what was the end date that you did for this? 88, 2000? When did you end it?
So my first study, I took the data all the way through 2002. And then when I decided to broaden it to add in the housing crisis as well, which I had always intended, but it was just I went through the study in phases, then I increased it and used data all the way through 2010.
Okay. All right. So that's what we have. What did you find?
Well, I found that in areas that were affected by the farm crisis, people who worked in agriculture became much more religious. And then in order to test the validity of that finding again, I decided to see, okay, well, what about people who were in those areas but not working in farming? So was it really just the effect of the crisis or was it just that people were becoming more religious in these areas overall? So then I ran the same econometric models, but instead of looking at people that worked in farming, I looked at people that worked in government. And precisely because of what you mentioned, that a crisis like this is going to also affect people who work at the feed store and people who work in manufacturing things like fertilizer and so on that supply the farmers. Everyone's affected by this. But I figured the least affected by it, so everyone's affected, would be people that work in government and have relatively stable civil service jobs. So I wanted to see if their religious behavior changed as a result of the crisis. And in fact, I found that it didn't. So the crisis affected farmers, or people who worked in agriculture, to be more precise, but it didn't actually change the religiosity of people that worked in government.
That is a very cool test. And again, this is the creativity of a scholar coming through to always be looking for an additional clue here or there. And the fact that the data presented these government workers who probably would not be affected by the crisis, stable jobs, et cetera, they're not going to feel the crisis. And you would hypothesize they would not be heading out to church at all or any more than they normally would. And that seems to be the case. Very, very cool finding. What's the magnitude of the effect here? Granted, we're dealing with samples and there's going to be some fuzziness to this, but I mean, are we just seeing a huge flood of people back to church, or is it just a marginal change? What kind of magnitude are we talking here?
The margin, to be precise, it's about a fifth of a standard deviation, but we have a pretty large standard deviation. So if we're looking at the exact size of the coefficient, let me explain the scale a little bit. So the scale is measured from 0 through 8, with 0 being you never attend, and 8 is where you attend more than once a week. And the size of my coefficient is about 0.5. So on an 8-point scale, you're moving up about half a step. So let me try and make sense of that in plain English. This would be somebody perhaps, that was, we don't measure it at a half scale, but yeah, somebody who was, say, a 6 on the scale moving to a 6.5, for example, in the aggregate.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about somebody who maybe attends once a month is now going to start attending twice a month.
Thereabouts. Yes.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
And when I broke it up by category and looked at each of these separate categories of attendance, in fact, I looked at that and found that, the decline in farmland prices, the largest effects were on the people that attended, called themselves attending nearly every week, and there was a much greater likelihood of people being in that particular category. So perhaps it was the occasional attenders that started, that increased their attendance to start to go nearly every week.
Okay. And so that's attendance. And I can see people attending because they're getting those social networks. They just, life is not really good right now, so I just want somebody else to be around. And, Sunday's a nice time to be around with everybody and maybe, ask God for, hey, what's going on here? Did you see any impact on religious attachment and prayer as well?
I did, yes. And it's not as dramatic an effect. And I think some of that is really just data, because the data on prayer, they only started asking in 82, and it's not, but yes, I definitely saw that. And I also saw an effect when instead of using just whether or not farm prices declined, I used a percentage change in the decline. So to actually look at the precise magnitude of the decline in farmland prices, I saw a similar sort of effect then as well.
Okay. And so this is interesting. The bigger effect tends to be on attendance rather than attachment or prayer.
Uh-huh.
Theoretically, what do you think is going on here? I mean, you got the numbers, the coefficients, so you see there's some correlation. But on the ground, if you had to explain this to somebody, what do you think is happening there?
I actually am hesitant to read too much into the prayer results just because the data don't line up as well. So I could read into it and say, perhaps people are intrinsically always as religious as they've always been, but they attend more for the social support. But that would be a step too far, and I'm not comfortable making that step precisely because it could just be that the coefficients are weaker and smaller because of the lack of data, because we're just missing those 8 years of data that we have for attendance that we don't have for the other things.
Well, you are a very humble social scientist. Most would say, you know, I'm going to make this big, huge claim so I can get in the New York Times, but you're doing social science the way it's supposed to be done, and that's kind of really nice. Another question I have, too, is as you extend this cross-sectional time series data across from the 70s into the 80s into the 90s, the 90s things start looking a little bit better. Do you see people then drifting away from church, you know, going from 3 weeks a month to 2 weeks?
Oh, yeah, this relationship holds across the entire sample. It weakens a little bit in the 2000s, but otherwise, yeah, we see increased attendance when farmland prices are low and decreased attendance as they rise.
Okay. And then this is what you've done recently, and this is really neat. You say, well, hey, we have another crisis here, one that is going to affect urban and suburban people a little bit more than farm areas. So that's the 2007 and 2008 crisis. And before we talk about it in relation to religiosity, fill us in. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are interested in saying, hey, you know, what happened 10 years ago? What's going on with the 2007-2008 financial crisis and housing crisis?
Right. So now the housing crisis, too, although it was nationwide, first of all, it wasn't as strongly felt, I should say, in rural areas. And then not only that, but it also affected certain parts of the country much more so than others. So, you know, if you were in Nevada, Florida, Arizona, California, it was enormous. I mean, it was absolutely catastrophic. And if you were in other parts of the country, yeah, it was bad. There were a lot of foreclosures going on and a lot of people were losing their jobs. But you didn't have these neighborhoods, entire neighborhoods that had been emptied out the way you did in these southwestern states and in Florida. So again, you had a big change in the level of the impact in these different places. So what I did in this particular case is I got an index of house prices by metro area from, and it's a Freddie Mac index. So I don't actually have the house prices. This isn't like the USDA data where I actually had average farmland prices by acre for each county. Here I have a house price index that Freddie Mac had already calculated.
But let me stop you here a second. Just go ahead and back up and give the standard mainline economic explanation for what happened in 2007 and 2008, even before we get to your study. So,
oh,
I mean,
okay.
Just everybody just stopped paying their mortgages at once, or what happened?
No, this is true, and I sometimes forget. It feels really recent for us, but every time I teach, now I teach college freshmen, and I have to explain it from scratch because I realize, wow, you guys were 11 years old when all this happened.
Yeah, 10 years ago almost. You know, so yeah. Nine years ago. Yeah.
So really, this started after the dot-com crash in 2000. Right. So in the late 1990s, we had the stock market boom that came from the dot-coms and the internet boom, and then that crashed. And in order to combat this crash in the stock market, and of course then 9/11 happened and we had a recession, the Federal Reserve cut interest rates very low. And because of these low interest rates, people that had money to invest were out there looking for a place that would give them a good return on their money, but at the same time they didn't want to go back to the stock market. It had just crashed. So people were out there looking for a place to put their money. And when I say people, this is global now. Right? So we're talking about money from all over the world that's looking for a place to invest. And at the same time, you had a big push in the U.S. housing market. I mean, clearly, we have all this government policy to encourage home buying. And not just home buying, but we have a lot of government policies to encourage borrowing money to buy your home, right? We have these tax deductions on mortgage interest. We have the FHA and Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and all of these institutions that exist to encourage people to buy homes and borrow money with a mortgage. And then a lot of other policies that encourage low down payments for first-time home buyers. So all of this institutional stuff was already there, along with a big push to lend, you know, to undo the effects of housing discrimination that have happened over decades, to try and lend to people that had previously faced discrimination and been unable to get mortgages. So all of these things are going on sort of at the same time. And all this money began to chase American homes. And while all of this was happening, we also have a widening trade deficit in the United States, which led to huge capital inflows. So it's not just American money that's looking for a return. This is money from around the world, including, you know, Europe and Japan and China and all these places that are looking for a place to invest their money, and especially places that had large trade surpluses with the United States, or with whom we had a large deficit, now had a lot of dollars that needed to be invested in something. And because the U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency, you know, if we were, say, Mexico or somebody, they would have just sold their extra dollars and the value of the dollar would have fallen. But a lot of people wanted to keep their currencies weak against the dollar, and they didn't want to do that. So that money all came back into the United States, and a lot of it from pension funds and so on around the world came back to the United States, got invested into our housing market. Meanwhile, Wall Street, of course, was inventing all of these new mortgage-backed securities and then collateralized debt obligations, which in turn were, I guess you could say, bets against the mortgage-backed securities, that they would rise or fall. And so a single mortgage-backed security then had enormous volumes of financial securities issued against it. And so the market just kept growing and growing and growing. And then in 2006, leverage restrictions on the investment banks were done away with. So they used to only be able to borrow a certain amount of money per, you know, for every dollar in capital they had. I think they were, originally they had to have 10-to-1 leverage ratios. And then that restriction was lifted, and they went in a very short time from 10-to-1 to about 60-to-1 leverage ratios, where the large investment banks were borrowing about close to $50 or $60 for every dollar of capital that they had. So you had massive amounts of leverage on top of all this that was going on. And so eventually, I mean, if people who remember the mid-2000s remember, it was crazy in that really if you wanted a mortgage, all you needed was a pulse. That people were willing to lend money to pretty much anybody to buy a house. And I was actually in Arizona at the time, and I remember I had friends that were graduate students buying houses and thinking to myself, this is crazy. Like, I know how much you make because I make the same amount. I mean, how can you buy a house, and who is lending you money to buy a house when you make what we make?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I remember this very well. Our first house we bought in the mid-90s, and we had to have a fair amount of money down. But then when we moved to our second one, you heard these ads, no money down. You know, if you're alive and breathing, we'll give you, you know, jumbo mortgage.
Like, exactly. Yeah. You could buy a $400,000 house with no money down almost, because you'd borrow 90% on one mortgage and 10% on another mortgage, a secondary mortgage to support your down payment. It was, and then you had all of these other crazy securities that were being issued and crazy types of mortgages, negative amortization mortgages. Those were a thing for a while where you didn't even pay off the entire principal every month. So the more you paid, the more you owed, because you were only paying a part of your interest every month.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, the madness finally came to an end in 2007 when interest rates were raised, and a lot of the people that had adjustable rate mortgages realized, oops, you know, it adjusted, and now I can't afford this new payment. And so they started to slowly default on their mortgages. And then, you know, as the economy started to turn down, and by the end of 2007, more and more people just, you know, they were out of a job, or they were financially in a more precipitous state than they were before. They couldn't afford to pay back their mortgage, and you had foreclosures around the country. And then what happened with the farm credit institutions way back in the 80s happened all over again in 2000s, which is banks and financial institutions that had lent money to people to buy these mortgages found themselves in trouble. And investment banks that had placed massive bets on mortgages and the collateralized debt obligations issued against them found themselves in trouble. AIG, which had sold a sort of insurance on these mortgages, which wasn't really insurance, but it was an option on the collateralized debt obligation that issued, that paid off if the obligations failed, well, they failed. And now AIG found itself having to make massive payments, and they had to be bailed out by the government. And so it was a massive global financial crisis. But the point is that it was still a huge asset price shock, and it was a massive crisis that affected a lot of people. A lot of people found themselves with a home that had been foreclosed on, you know, homeless after having supposedly achieved the American dream. And again, that this effect was more concentrated in states, some states like Nevada, Florida, Arizona, and California, where more people had bought homes and heavily leveraged their home purchases. So I figured, well, what went on with the farmers, probably happened again. And so I did a similar model where I looked at, this time I looked at people that worked in a housing-related industry to see how they were affected by this. And I found that it didn't actually matter in this case whether house prices rose or fell. So initially I'd had an indicator variable just for farmland prices, whether they rose or fell. And that turned out not to matter. And when I thought about that, I realized, well, of course, because it was nationwide. I mean, house prices fell around the country. So it didn't really matter. But then when I looked at the actual magnitude of the decline in house prices, I now found a similar effect, that people became a lot more religious or started at least attending religious services much more in places that had seen larger percentage changes in the house price index.
Okay, so the places like Arizona and Florida.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. And did you find the same things in terms of prayer and what adherence or adherence to religious belief or whatever?
That is a work in progress at the moment.
All right.
I'm still putting some of that data together, but yes, that's coming along.
So when you look at a housing-related industry, what kind of folks are you looking at here, like carpenters, real estate agents, those kind of folks?
I'm looking mostly at people who work either in construction or realtors or those who sell construction-related equipment and architects and so on.
Oh, that's true. I wouldn't have thought construction. Yeah, like, you know, bulldozers and stuff like that. Yeah, okay, that's a good one. And did you do the same kind of control with government workers?
Yes, I did, and I found exactly the same thing, that people who worked in government didn't seem to change their behavior.
Right? Okay. Yeah, very cool. So it's a neat – this is one of these really neat studies that you find something in one area, and with this big emphasis now on replication of studies, you can replicate with the same data to see if you get the same results, or find something very similar to see if you get the same kind of effects as well. And that's exactly what you did. So very exciting to see that, I guess.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you've done some other stuff here related to this too, and you're working, you have another working paper, and I want to kind of see if we can find some results from this. Again, it's a work in progress, but it's something called Religion, Domestic Violence, and the Economic Crisis. So here, you're even taking this one step further. Tell us about this project. I think you're working on it with Marlena Primo and Anne Bianchi.
Yes, and they're actually over in the College of Nursing. And the reason I'm working with them on it is precisely because the particular issue I'm looking at in this case is domestic violence in general, and in particular intimate partner violence. And they're both specialists and experts in that area. So that itself has been a really interesting journey, I guess, an intellectual journey, is working with nursing faculty members. And I mean, they're not just nursing professors. They've spent a large part of their career actually as nurses on the ground and working with victims of intimate partner violence as well. What we figured in this case was, you know, of course we know about, you know, this housing crisis and the economic crisis, and the thought was, we know that poverty and unemployment and basically issues like that, or severe stresses and crises, tend to influence intimate partner violence. We see more of it in these sorts of situations. When people, families are under stress, when they're under financial stress, you see more intimate partner violence. So we wanted to look at what actually happened as a result of the crisis. So we got hospital data from the state of Florida, and this is data on every hospital admission in the state of Florida, and it goes back decades, but we started out by analyzing just the year 2000 onwards. And the reason we looked at 2000 onwards is that's when they started measuring readmissions and tracking readmissions with the same person. So what we wanted to look at is what's going on in terms of, are people actually more likely to be readmitted as victims of assault in, you know, under certain circumstances. So not just are they likely to be a victim, but frequently with intimate partner violence and domestic violence, you tend to see a perpetrator just, you know, the offense keeps being repeated, essentially. It's not a one-time thing a lot of the time. People have these patterns of behavior that are hard to break out of and pretty much, you know, don't end typically until a relationship ends. And so you see a lot of repeat offenders. I mean, this is going to sound awful, but I was once speaking to a group of police officers about this, and they even referred to, oh, yeah, we know who those families are. We call them our frequent flyers. It really is that bad. So we wanted to look at what the factors that affect the sort of repeat offending. And because Florida actually started tracking readmissions after that, we looked in particular at that. And so, yeah, we tracked it with the house price index. We looked at the male-female wage ratio. But then, because we were looking at relatively more recent data, I also wondered, and it wasn't something I had seen anyone do. It was, again, just my idle wonderings. One of the luxuries of being an academic, if you have a strange idea, we get paid to do research and test our strange ideas. But I wondered if religiosity in a certain area might relate to people's online behavior. So I looked at the data on Google searches. And the reason I did that is a lot of our other religiosity data is, you know, it's every year, or in the case of GSS now, it's every other year, right? And the census, the ARDA census of religious congregations, is every decade. So if I wanted data that was more, I guess, measured at more regular intervals, I thought, well, maybe this will have some interesting results, and maybe it'll correlate with our other measures of religiosity. So I wanted to see what happens. Does religion actually have a protective effect for intimate partner violence? Or is the old stereotype about religion and the patriarchy true, that religious households are also more patriarchal and we might see more intimate partner violence in these places? So I used the intensity of Google searches on certain religious terms, and then also controlled for the intensity of Google searches for terms related to domestic violence and divorce and things like that, and to see if those had an effect on intimate partner violence and the probability of readmission.
Okay, before we get to the results here, in terms of the Google searches, for me, this is a new era of research. I did all my quantitative training back in the 90s before the internet, and even actually had card files when we were programming SPSS. That's how ancient I am here. But this Google searches, you can get data on this of people who are now what kind of terms are you looking for? Where is the local church? Or, does God still love me? Or what kind of things are you looking for in that search?
All right. So the first thing is, Google actually makes all of its search data intensity available. And they do this, of course, for their own purposes. They want people to advertise with them. And if you want to advertise with them in a targeted way, you have to know what people are searching for so you can tie your ads to certain keywords. So the data is absolutely freely available to anybody who wants it. But the downside is that they construct their own index of intensity of searches for a certain topic, and they keep that bit of how the index is constructed proprietary.
Okay. So you're doing what you can with the data that you have.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. I buy that. So what are the findings here? What do we see in terms of just domestic violence per se, and then also how religion relates to this domestic violence issue and economic crisis?
All right. So it turns out, actually, that in fact, in places that had a higher percentage change in the house price, right? So in places where the house prices are falling, right? Unfortunately, our prediction did bear out that places we do see this uptick in hospital admissions for assault among women. With respect to the Google searches, I kept my search terms as broad as possible. So I kept thinking, I used phrases like Christian and Jesus, which is not just the word, but you can set your terms up so that it searches for any phrase, including those. And I didn't want to narrow it down too much. I wanted to keep it broad just to get more data on it. So the interesting thing I found is actually in places that do see this big change in the house prices, let me explain that coefficient a little bit. If there's an increase in house prices and there are more searches for Jesus, okay, in that area, then we actually see an increase in our assault admissions, which actually means that in places that suffered a decline in house prices, right, religion kind of had a protective effect. But we also found that in places that had this decline in house prices, where there was more searches just for the phrase domestic violence, we actually saw an increase in domestic violence, which I think is probably an indicator that victims are looking for help, and they're looking online, because nowadays that's where we look. If you need help with anything, you look online.
I see. Yeah. And I can see how this is all somewhat endogenously related.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
So, difficult to
But we definitely see that. And in a way, that was good news, because although it is endogenous, it shows us that things are picking up what we expect them to pick up.
Okay.
Right? So it's not just meaningless noise.
Wow. Really interesting stuff. And we're going to have to follow this to when it gets published and things, and we'll let people know where it is, because the creativity of this kind of study using Google searches and housing prices and putting all this stuff together is just really cool. Really cool research.
Thank you.
Let me kind of finish up here and ask you, since you're doing all this really cool research, you're one of the more imaginative researchers in this whole area, and for an economist, not just focusing on housing prices, but throwing in these other variables, domestic violence and religion as well. What other kind of stuff are you actually looking into?
Are you talking about the rest of my research?
Yeah. Actually, let me back up, too. I'll come back to that question, but there's one other. This is just kind of an inside baseball question for academics here, but you mentioned that this domestic violence study, you were working with a couple nurses. I mean, how did you ever find them? I mean, are these people you have lunch with daily, they're neighbors of yours, or was there some talk on campus about domestic violence? You said, I'm going to attend that, and then all of a sudden it sparks an idea, because, we oftentimes think that research is institutionalized to happen a certain way, but there's oftentimes these just fortuitous events that things fall into your lap. And I'm kind of curious how you came to meet these nurses and stuff.
Well, actually, I was interested in the subject. I have been so. Domestic violence has been another subject that I've been interested in. I've also helped, now and then I've volunteered at local nonprofits that deal with it and that sort of thing. So it's been just, at a different level, just a subject I feel kind of strongly about. But then, yeah, as you mentioned, making connections in a strange way. Actually, Marlena, one summer, was teaching classes, and the nursing building was being renovated. They were adding a new wing to it. And so they weren't able to use their classrooms that summer, and she was teaching her classes over in our building. And just eating lunch in our lounge with us. And so we started to talk and became friends, and it just sparked from there. And then I found out that, she was not just a nursing professor, not just interested in the issue, but had been a domestic violence responder, a primary responder, and, again, was a real expert in the field. And it just went on from there.
That's absolutely fascinating. Again, for our graduate students listening, and they oftentimes wonder, well, where do you get a dissertation topic or a topic for a new research paper? And you say they're laying all over the place. You just got to keep your eyes open and keep your mind open to every opportunity that comes about. So, which then leads me back to that question I asked a minute ago: is what else are you doing in terms of religion? Because you really are. Opening a lot of doors in different research avenues.
Well, on religion, I would say at the moment, these are the two big ones. I mean, at a certain point, I want to revisit the corruption and rule of law study with North and Gwynn, and, go back to that and look at that. I'm doing a lot of experimental work, and I have an experiment actually that's ongoing that looks at how people choose institutions providing local public goods. This is going back to the club model of religion. And that's also currently a work in progress.
Go ahead and explain that, what the club model version of religion and what you're trying to do with this experimental study is.
All right, so the club model of religion, and this is the Yannacone and Berman stuff that we talked about at the beginning, is the idea of thinking about religion as a local public good. It's something that provides benefits to its members, but it needs its members to actually contribute to provide these benefits. And these benefits could be whatever. They could be something actually tangible and physical, monetary, whatever, or they could just be the spiritual and emotional aspects of it. But somebody's got to be in there at the Bible study, somebody's got to be in there helping out or just providing the coffee and the snacks at the break. You've got to have, and then you have to have people that are even enforcing the rules and the norms of a community, which in fact help bind that community together. And so some of the really interesting and insightful work that Yannacone has done has shown that people and communities actually use highly visible signs as a way to screen people, to screen out free riders, people who will just use the services on offer without contributing to them. So a lot of very visible sacrifices that people might make, or signs, you know, for example, not eating certain things, you know, the dietary restrictions and dress restrictions that don't seem to actually have any intrinsic purpose as far as economists are concerned, but they serve as a signaling device that you're a true believer, you're really committed here because you're doing all these things. So people use these ways of showing how committed they are. And that helps sort of bind people together in these groups and helps screen out free riders. Well, public goods experiments are very common, but I set up an experiment where people actually had to choose a community, choose a local public good that was then provided if everybody contributed. And I set them up in such a way that there was one group that had a sort of mandatory contribution and one which did not. You'd go in and then contribute if you wanted to. And I found, in fact, that sure enough, as one would expect, the mandatory contribution really helps. It draws people in. It reduces free riding. And then I also found, so another prediction is, in fact, that people with what economists call a higher opportunity cost of time would be less likely to contribute. And I found that holds true as well, that people with a higher opportunity cost of contributing tend to contribute less.
Very cool. Very cool stuff. And we will keep watching to see what kind of results you get and have you back on the show on this. I want to finish off with just one general reflective question. I always love to ask my guests this, and this is studying all this stuff about religion, which you mentioned early on. You had this guest appearance by Ellie Berman at Arizona, and all of a sudden a light went off in your head. And so over the past decade or so, you've had the ability to really go through this and think about how your research agenda has developed and your different findings. What have you learned over this course of study that has really surprised you that maybe 15, 20 years ago you would have never thought would have occurred to you?
Well, so one enormous thing I think that has come out of it is that a lot of behavior that people perceive as irrational actually makes a lot of sense in context. So, for example, people see a lot of the rituals associated with religion as meaningless. You know, you'll often hear people discuss that, you know, meaningless rituals. And it turns out that actually those supposedly meaningless rituals are some of the most important parts of a religion, because they're what serve as that signal that binds people together. And they're what allow that community to exist and keep it strong and cohesive and minimize free riding. That was just enormously insightful. And I think that led to a broader way of thinking that, in fact, if some behavior seems puzzling, mysterious, you know, you can't seem to, it's crazy, it's irrational, well then, you probably just don't understand people's utility functions and their constraints. And it turns out that once you understand what people's goals are, what they're really trying to achieve and what constraints they operate under, then a lot of behavior that seems puzzling, mysterious, hard to understand ends up making a lot of sense.
Yeah. No, it's the same insights that I have. So we're kind of on the same intellectual journey here. And I am so glad that you are able to share your research. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we will link to a website that has a number of your papers, your working papers and published papers, so people can go check these things out, because really fascinating work that you have been doing. And I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion. My guest today has been Wafa Hakeem Orman. Thanks for being on Research on Religion.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.